the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Tuesday, July 2nd, and we are still here. We're here for a public hearing today on Senate Bill 437A relating to higher education. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 437A and would request Senator Clarno's staff to come forward and testify. And at the completion of that testimony, I'll be calling forward Mr. Craven from the American Electronics Association. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave. I'm here at the request of Senator Clarno to testify in favor of Senate Bill 437, the Higher Ed Efficiency Act. And rather than going into detail on exactly all the components of the bill, I just would like to state on the record that this bill is definitely important in our continuing landscape and involve as we evolve this session and identify new efficiencies. We really feel that some of the provisions of this bill need to be discussed in the continuing landscape of our education system in Oregon, and we think that many of the provisions do offer up the potential for money savings and efficiencies for our university system. So with that, I'll close my testimony and invite any detailed questions to the good representatives from the Oregon University system.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments from Mr. Clee? Thank you for taking your time, and please convey our thanks to Senator Clarno for her input.
I will. Thank you.
Chair calls Mr. Craven. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the Oregon Council of the American Electronics Association. We appreciate you hearing Senate Bill 437 today. We think it's an important piece of the picture for your discussions of higher education this session. For a number of years, we've had a wide-ranging debate about the efforts to provide additional efficiencies and flexibility to our campuses, our public universities in Oregon. About a year ago, President Frohmeyer from the University of Oregon and his senior staff met with me, with Duncan Weiss from the Oregon Business Council, and with Mike Salzgiver at the time, with Intel now, with the Portland Business Alliance, and presented a pretty broad-ranging concept about many of the items that are contained in Senate Bill 437. And our challenge to President Frohmeyer was to go out and get the support of all the campus presidents, as well as the State Board of Higher Education, and come back to us with a united front. Well, they did so over the ensuing several months, and that resulted in this bill being introduced at the request of the American Electronics Association, Associate Oregon Industries, the Portland Business Alliance, and the Oregon Business Council, as well as, I guess, 60-plus co-sponsors from members of the Senate and the House. There are a lot of details in this bill, and we have experts who will be following us to explain them piece by piece and answer your questions. We're here today to urge your support and serious consideration of this bill. We think it's critical that, particularly in these tough budget times, that we provide some additional tools to our public universities to save some money in efficiencies, to provide a little more flexibility and an entrepreneurial spirit as they manage the whole system of higher ed and as the individual campuses manage themselves. Just to say that this is not the full meal deal. This is not the Oregon Health Sciences University model. We're not asking that the enterprise become a public corporation. I think passage of Senate Bill 437 will continue to provide plenty of interaction with the legislative assembly, and oversight capability for the members of this body. I think part of what the bill does is provide a little less interchange and oversight of other agencies vis-a-vis the Oregon University system, but still keeps the system closely wedded to this body in a lot of key decisions. So it's not the Oregon Health Sciences model. It is, but it's progress in the right direction, we think, and we urge your support and serious consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments for Mr. Craven?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, I am Keith Thompson of Portland, speaking today on behalf of the Oregon Business Council. The passage of Senate Bill 437 and its companion bill, SJR 7, is one of the key legislative goals of the Oregon Business Council and is included in the Oregon Business Plan. OBC is one of the requesters listed at the top of the bill, along with its partners from the industry and business community. It should be no surprise that I strongly urge your support for this bill. I have written about this legislation in a piece that appeared in the Portland Business Journal earlier this year, and it has the support of editorial boards across the state, including the Oregonian Register Guard and others. Most recently, the changes sought in Senate Bill 437 were mentioned for a second time in an editorial in the Oregonian. On June 22nd, under the title 10 Chores Before Adjournment, the Oregonian stated that our higher education system needs flexibility to survive and that the interest on tuition should be funneled into student aid, not the state's general fund. As a retired vice president of Intel Corporation, I know firsthand the importance of a highly educated workforce, not only from my own semiconductor industry where employees control computers that are building computers, but also for wheat farmers in eastern Oregon using GPS-guided tractors that apply fertilizer using satellite imagery, to mill workers in central and southern Oregon using computers that scan and maximize the yield from precious logs. It is not only the new burgeoning high-tech companies in the field of computers, material science, and biotechnology that will likely lead Oregon back to economic health, but also Oregon's traditional industries using high technology to compete in the global economy. All of our industries now depend on a highly educated workforce to remain competitive. We have never had a greater need for a high-quality university system. So why is Oregon disinvesting in higher education? Why has the higher education budget remained flat for more than a decade despite inflation and despite the record number of high school students who are choosing Oregon universities? This is an unsustainable and unacceptable trend. Fortunately, our public universities have a plan to deal with this crisis, and that plan is before you today in Senate Bill 437. In an era of limited state assistance, Senate Bill 437 will allow our universities to continue to survive and provide quality as well as access. As you know, part of the plan asks the legislature to loosen its constraints on our universities. That should be a simple choice. Madam Chair and members, higher education is not just another expenditure. It is an investment in Oregon's future. If we are truly committed to growing our economy, you will give our universities the changes they seek to effectively use every dollar they earn. The Oregon business community supports this bill. Now we need your support. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I will be happy to answer any questions.
Questions or comments for Mr. Thompson? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedules to come and speak to us today. I have on my agenda a representative from Associated Oregon Industries and the Portland Business Alliance.
Madam Chair, Harvey Matthews is suffering from an eye infection and out of service. And Mr. Salzgiver, I believe, had a message to Mr. Craven to pass on his support, too.
Thank you very much. Then I will call Chancellor Jarvis. Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Jarvis, Chancellor of the Oregon University System. I'd like to speak to three elements of the context for this bill, if I may. The first is the work of the State Board of Higher Education, and in particular its Strategic Planning Committee, who have been engaged in a strategic planning project for the past 2 years now, examining all of the main policy agendas of the Oregon University system. Among those are the ways in which we relate to the rest of state government, the rest of the educational sectors within the state, and indeed the way in which we do our business. Part of their considerations have led to studies of the efficiencies with which we conduct our activities as part of government of this state, and part of that thinking brings to you the set of efficiency proposals contained in the bill under consideration today. The second factor is the desire of the presidents of our universities to seek out more efficient practices on their campuses and more efficient practices in the ways in which we interact with state government, way we're able to invest our income, to generate revenue, to secure resources, and to do more with the resources that the state provides. Their purpose is to enable us to teach more students and to conduct more research, to expand the program base that we deliver, and because of that, we've identified a number of ways in which we believe we can work better, faster, and more economically in our relationships with state government. In all of those, we will maintain and indeed increase our accountability within the system to the State Board of Higher Education and through the State Board to state government and you. The third factor is the all too familiar one of the pressure on state funding and what that means for our ability to maintain access. That's, of course, an overwhelming priority in all of our meetings with you this spring. We know that the extent of state resources in the next biennium will simply not be able to support through general fund alone all of the students who will be qualified and seek the benefits of a baccalaureate education and beyond. So the point of these reforms is to provide us with a way to increase the number of students that our institutions can support. When state general fund has been determined, that will set the number of students that each of our institutions can enroll through the course of the next biennium through the resource allocation model. That'll determine the infrastructure that supports the research our faculty can do and their ability to secure grants and contracts. Beyond that, our institutions will be supporting thousands of students on the basis of tuition alone. And beyond that, we believe there are a significant number of additional students we could reach out and serve if the elements of this Efficiency Act were approved and we're given a chance to operate in these new ways. So this is about efficiency and flexibility. It is not about OUS ceasing to be a state agency. As I've said many times, there are some 750 million of the very best reasons why we both need and very much want to remain a state agency, a number which we'd be happy to see increased in any possible way. This is about the way in which we relate to and do the business we do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee.
If I might ask a question, Chancellor Jarvis, we're receiving information that the university systems in virtually every state are feeling the same kind of stresses that we're feeling within our university system and our state budget constraints right now. I would imagine that there are not a lot of ways that the states are dealing with this, that there's a lot of commonality between how states are dealing with it. Have you got any information relating to the kinds of things that are proposed in Senate Bill 437? If these kinds of things are also being talked about or proposed in other states?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to compile a summary of that for you. There's been a lot of reporting in the higher educational literature about attempts to trade reductions in state support for increases in flexibility, and that's very much on the mind of several states this year. It also relates to the substitutions of general fund and tuition that's happening in many, many states, and we're all facing these same kinds of issues. But the need for flexibility on the part of the campuses and the need for new ways of doing business is very much on the mind of several states, and I'll be happy to pull some of those examples together for you.
Thank you very much. Are there further questions or comments? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jarvis, I like this bill a lot. I'm one of the main co-sponsors on it. I think past legislatures time and time again have said universities, you need to go out and be more entrepreneurial and do this and do this and do this. And then when you bring something forward like this that really allows you to do that, sometimes you're met with resistance. And that's too bad in a way. But I do have a couple of questions. It says, and this may be relating to the amendments, it says, allows OUS institutions to enter into transactions for intellectual property. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought we allowed for that in a law that we passed last session.
Representative Smith, members of the committee, let me call up on someone with some greater institutional memory than me on that one, if I may. Is that
Mr. Kearns, please.
Representative Smith and Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Diane Vines, Vice Chancellor for the Oregon University System. Yes, you did allow campuses to hold stock in companies that commercialize their technologies, and in fact, the voters passed that constitutional amendment by 77% of popular vote. Mm-hmm. This is actually an additional area of flexibility that is being requested for campuses to enter into agreements with more flexibility and sort of more being more masters of their own fate. So this is an additional amount of flexibility that we're requesting.
Right. Explain how is it additional?
Especially in terms of contracting, for example, and opportunities for campuses to make those determinations directly with companies with somewhat more flexibility from the Department of Justice. And I think this relates specifically to the agreement that's been reached with the Attorney General on actions that the Attorney General would take to increase that flexibility.
I see. So you've been in contact with the AG's office to...
Yeah.
And will this, does this go far enough? Is there still any gray areas left since we've had what we did in the legislature, the initiative that went to the people, and then this? Are we fully involved in our intellectual property area?
Representative, members of the committee, I think this takes us a long way down that path. We are looking to find expedited review with the Department of Justice. We think that we'll make a lot of progress this biennium, and we can get this done through interagency agreement. But those facts remain to be delivered, and we'll look to work closely with business and industry as we develop those relationships, do a post-audit process on all of our review activities as we conduct those. So we're trying to provide more accountability both to business and industry and to you as we go through these transfer activities.
Well, yeah, it would be wonderful to keep the discoveries here in Oregon and let Oregon profit from them and then let them not go out of state or slip through the hands through legal wrangling and maneuvering that I'm sure that often goes on. I have another question.
If I might follow up to the question that you just asked, I'm not getting a clear picture of, I know that we're working at the Dash 17s now, and we're working off this description that you've handed out to us, but I know that there are questions that arose in the what you wanted to have happen with the Secretary of State's office or the Department of Justice backing out of being involved in helping you negotiate contracts. What I'm not clear on is exactly what substantively you are agreeing with them on now and what procedures they're willing to do with you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee.
If you'd like to just stay there, I'm sure that it would save you a lot of exercise over the long run.
The substantive agreements go to timelines for review between the campuses, the system office, and Department of Justice, so that we've laid out so many days for getting a review, so many days for turning things around, whereas previously these could slide off into lengthy time delay.
If I might, could you just back me up one square and talk to me about what the nature of the contracts are? What are the scope of the contracts that are on the table here?
I think we're talking about review for the transfer of intellectual property for setting up companies, for commercializing activities, and for creating relationships between university entities and non-university entities. And there's a whole lot of legal sufficiency review that has to take place there. We're trying to speed that up and put some accountable timelines in there, and then at the end of each of these projects to have a sort of post-review audit where we would sit down with the Department of Justice, with the business representatives, and say, how did this process work through? Where was it held up? What are the elements that we could improve? So we've tried to put in a quality improvement element to this, which has been absent in any of that relationship before.
So am I correct then in assuming that the process itself won't change? What's been added is a review and refinement part to it?
Madam Chair, I think the process has changed because we're now on strict timelines for completing the reviews that legally must take place.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, for the record, Greg and Karen's Director of Government Relations, Oregon University System, and got a copy of the agreement dated May 8, 2003, which I'll share with the committee so that you can see it. The background was that the bill as printed would have excised Department of Justice oversight on all of these business practices for the Oregon University System. The Department of Justice and the Attorney General protested very strongly. We had private conversations at the direction of the Education Committee Chair, directed the DOJ and OUS to go and see if there was a way to settle it without having a collision. This interagency agreement is the result of that, signed by both parties and in effect, and give you an idea of the things that are included. It allows OUS authorized to enter into a broad range of business transactions in furtherance of its statutory missions, allowing that so that you post-audit that instead of sending these things up, going through the bureaucracy, coming through a review, and coming back with an answer. You have the authority to go and engage in those transactions, and there is a post-audit review of those transactions to always try and improve to the best practices possible. Allows the DOJ to continue review for legal sufficiency of those, but cites the originating authority in the OUS. It also lays out the DOJ service agreements, which were at issue in that, on timeliness, the timelines for those things to happen, to provide for a standard priority business transaction framework for the system to work in so that you didn't arise anew. It wasn't de novo every transaction. And it's a very good and, as I'm afraid, detailed. We let the lawyers loose, and they went to page 6 with 2 pages of appendices, but we'll share it with you. And it represents the beginning of part of the intention of 437, now already in practice.
And we don't at this point have a copy of that memorandum?
I have one here, and I'll give it to staff.
If you could make it available to Mr. Bender, he would distribute to us. I think that would be useful information for us to have.
Happy to do that.
Thank you. Representative Smith, you had a follow-up question.
Another item that's in the Dash-8 amendments. OUS attorneys allows OUS attorneys and employees to represent OUS at contested case hearings.
I'm sorry, which amendments?
It allows OUS to use their own attorneys to represent OUS at contested case hearings.
That is an earlier set of amendments, I believe. We're working on the A-17.
Okay, it says on my staff summary.
I think Representative Smith is referring to the committee summary measure that was on the original.
So that is out of it?
Oh, yes.
That's
ma'am.
Out? Okay. Thank you.
Did you have a follow-up, Representative Smith?
No.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate your being here to kind of help us walk through this, and I, too, am a sponsor, so I have a great deal of interest in this bill. There are a couple of provisions. It looks like the Dash-17s remove the discussions in the engrossed version of the bill around collective bargaining and health plans and benefit plans. That's correct. Okay, thank you. And then secondly, and this has been in the original versions too, in section 3 would be page 4 of the Dash-17s, and it talks about the board may also establish exemptions from the competitive procedures when appropriate. Could you just kind of give me some ideas of what you think the board would find as appropriate reasons to not use the competitive bidding process?
Madam Chair and Representative March, that would be where a by guidelines and by internal memoranda, the board would provide campuses the ability to step out of the competitive process when there was a need to make a purchase or contract immediately under some circumstances that wouldn't permit for a lengthy kind of process. We can probably provide you some additional examples, but it's meant to be an exception process, not a rule.
Thank you.
Although our representatives, if I could, Senator Mesley has been waiting, so
it's fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this was covered earlier, and I apologize for coming in late, but there's an awful lot of language here about interest earning staying within the fund itself. Do we have a compilation of those figures of how much money are we talking about? I assume that money presently goes back to the general fund, and just not that I'm opposed to that, to leaving it in the funds where it was originally authorized, but I'd like to know what the total amount is.
Mr. Bender.
We are waiting for the Legislative Revenue Office is working on a particular figure for the impact for that. You may recall last week when you heard about the governor's trust fund proposal for student aid, that had a provision, or that one of the provisions to fund that in the governor's proposal is to use the interest that is being earned on tuition dollars at the Oregon University system as one of the sources to fund that trust fund. And you were told at that time that that would be approximately $5 million per biennium. What Senate Bill 437 does is it actually is in conflict, I believe, with the governor's other proposal in this instance, because it takes these funds and instead appropriates them to the university systems, or more specifically to the campuses that are collecting the funds, but it would have the same general fund impact, assuming that's what the numbers are confirmed, of approximately $5 million. I do, though, believe that perhaps the provisions in Senate Bill 437 are a little broader mm-hmm. than they were in the governor's other proposal, because this would also take funds that are being received, for example, on housing fees or dining fees, and also use those interest payments, which are currently going to the general fund, would no longer do that. So it would be a larger number than the $5 million.
Mr. Bender, do you know if that $5 million number was built on the revised tuition numbers, or was that based on some historical data?
We do not know that. I'm sorry. And as I said, we are in conversations with the Revenue Office, who is looking into that issue further and should have a number.
Would it be kind of a wash, seeing that more tuition but less interest, seeing as this interest rates are down? So, I mean, you know, six one way, half a dozen the other.
Yeah. I can't confirm how the $5 million figure was calculated.
Follow-up, Senator?
Not fine, thanks.
Representative Smith.
I noticed this bill has an emergency clause on it. Isn't it a revenue bill?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I defer that question to your staff. I wouldn't think so. It shifts revenue from one source to another, but doesn't raise it.
Yeah. Right. And we believe that it wouldn't fall under the provisions of a bill to raise revenue for which an emergency clause is not allowed.
Right.
And legislative counsel has agreed with that as well and therefore committed the bill to be drafted.
Another question. Going back to what Representative March asked, you took out the provision of health benefit insurance, you know, being apart from PIB, and I think the universities wanted to establish their own group, because I think maybe the thinking was that university instructors, professors, whatever you want to call them, are usually low risk as far as that type of insurance is concerned. Why was that taken out?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, to your question, Representative Smith, you're correct that there's a number of things involved in the insurance interests that the faculty have, one of which is the fact that, of course, it is a group that has a lower experience rate in terms of usage and utility, but also they have for many years under, when we had, they were under SEB, State Employee Benefit Board, different from BUB, Bargaining Unit Benefit Board, those two plans looked materially different. There was a much more of a cafeteria model, or actually even a smorgasbord, if you wish, of elements that you could choose and modify and tailor a plan. The BUB was much more uniform, full family coverage, and had a standardized look to it. When those were merged, much of the flexibility in that previous plan was lost. That has gone away. We're now under a common plan for everyone. And so the opt-out, cashback, and other flexibility issues that the faculty have long been interested in, and which we were, of course, very supportive of as part of a total compensation package, has been blended in. The governor's office talked to us at great length about it, flagged that early. We had lengthy conversations with the Public Employees Benefit Board and tried a variety of amendments to see if we couldn't find a way around that. We were unable to. We tried, the last one was to have PEB have the right of first refusal to be our contracting agent, but it would be for a tailored plan. Problem with that is that it leaves stranded costs for PEB to cover for which they would not be reimbursed from our plan. So they have objected and said that, quite frankly, they would resist the measure very strongly, and the governor's office told us the same thing. If those were contained in the bill, they have been taken out in the A-17 amendments. That leaves us with the status quo of a right which was given by the legislature in Senate Bill 271, the first Administrative Efficiency Act, which says that we can withdraw as an agency from PEB for a plan that is of similar benefit and lower cost. We could exercise that right if we could find a way to turn the key to do that, but we have withdrawn from the greater amendment, which would allow us to simply withdraw without that threshold.
Follow up? This is not necessarily a question for these gentlemen, but a question needs to be asked. Is it to PEB's benefit to have the Oregon University assistant employees in it? And is maybe that that's the reason that amendment was taken out of the bill?
Ren, I'm not sure that these are the correct people to ask that question.
That's what I'm...
That we
but I would like...
We could
yeah.
get someone from PEB in here to answer that question.
I would like that question because if it's to PEB's benefit, because these employees are maybe low cost.
Well, but I would also ask you to consider, Representative Smith, that that provision has been taken out of the bill, so it really isn't subject to discussion anymore.
Madam Chair, if the PEB representative were here, they would say that we're running up against the law of adverse selection in terms of insurance and trying to isolate a low cost, an island, a low cost set of insureds from a larger pool that would be left with the adverse selection of paying for the higher cost. The second one would be, they would tell you, that it runs against the idea of a larger and larger pool of insureds in order to moderate costs and to get greater purchasing authority. And as Pat would tell you, you are looking at legislation to extend common pools to larger groups of public employees, and we would be moving in a 180-degree direction away from those two principles. Our response would be that we would like to have the status quo ante of the plan we left when SEB was abolished, but they would say the cost for that would be shared by other insurers. So it is a policy issue, and if you want to pursue it, I'm sure they'd be glad to come and tell you those things.
Don't move yet.
Madam Chair, we've got a couple other witnesses and some, but we'd be happy to.
I would like to get a little bit more discussion on the public record around the exemptions from competitive bidding procedures. And what I'd like you to do, if you could, is we've had a discussion, I think, in response to Representative March's question around this being an exception process and to be used in cases of emergencies. And I'm wondering what constitutes an emergency in the higher education arena.
Madam Chair, if you would permit me, I'd like to ask the members of the Administrative Affairs Council, that would be the Vice Presidents for Administration, and their business managers to provide you with written response to that next week, if we could, after the holiday.
That would be very acceptable. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, Chancellor Jarvis, we have hopelessly just derailed your presentation. So are you done?
Madam Chair, I was finished with the begging moment about the $750
million. I remember that.
Thank you.
President Frohnmayer, you are next on my list, and President White is also on my list. If you'd both like to come up, that would be wonderful. Good morning.
Thank you very much, Chair Morgan. For the record, I'm Dave Frohnmayer, President of the University of Oregon. Very much appreciate your willingness to advance this bill on the hearing schedule. It's a very important landmark in what we hope is a successful route to its passage, and we thank you for the hearing opportunity. We also thank Representative Smith for co-sponsoring this bill and for the many others, such as Representative March, who've also taken an active interest in sponsorship in the measure, which we consider to be very important, together with its companion bill, Senate Joint Resolution 7, which we trust will be heard in a separate but expeditious way. I want to begin, if I may, by emphasizing something that I'm sure the committee knows and which two people who have preceded me have testified to, but which is nonetheless worth talking about, and that is that higher education isn't simply an expenditure. And I suppose that in a committee which is overwhelmed by budgets day after day, week after week, one hears the sense that this is somehow different. And yet I would argue to you that higher education for a state and its public universities is uniquely different. It is not simply an expenditure. It is a major investment, and one that has tangible payoff, and tangible payoff both in the short run and in the long run. We know that in terms of our economic future. We know that in terms of what it means to have an educated workforce. We know what it means in terms of the state's competitiveness nationally and internationally. So it is an investment in an economic future, and this is true nationally. I would call your attention to a recent estimate made about America's research universities that suggests and proves with very substantial documentation that about one half of the growth of the gross domestic product since World War II in the United States of America is directly due to the contributions of America's universities. That's an astonishing figure. It's one that is, I believe, accurate, and it testifies to the importance of what it is that we're talking about today and part of the context in which we appear today. The University of Oregon, for example, is Oregon's 18th largest employer. Our employees pay income taxes. They are taxpayers, not simply the recipients of tax dollars. The University of Oregon returns $10 to this state's economy for every $1 of general fund that is invested in it every single year. That's the result of an economic study, not merely a ballpark estimate. We'd be happy to provide that for you if we may. Our graduates return $1.60 in income taxes for every dollar the state invests in their education. If we bring 100 international students to the state of Oregon each year, we are bringing the state of Oregon $1 million every year from an out-of-state source that adds to the people who spend money on goods and services doing business with Oregon entrepreneurs. We do business with 4,000 Oregon companies every year. 86% of what we gather in income we spend in the state of Oregon. So this is a major economic entity with major impacts for the health and livelihood of people, not merely in the immediate community of our universities, but all throughout the state. And that context, I hope, is important, given the fact of the choices that you very painfully have to face. We know that the efforts that the legislature is making and that you are forced to make every day are heroic. We know also that higher education has been cut, and even under the best of scenarios, will be cut below the expenditure levels that we have been engaged in over the last several years. What I'm asking you to look to is our funding dilemma and a partial solution, which is embodied in Senate Bill 437, which is why it is before you. We're being pulled in two directions. One is the direction of rising enrollments by kids who get it. And these aren't all kids, by the way. They're not so young, many of them, but they recognize the imperative of higher education. And the fact that the difference between a high school education and a college education right now is $1 million of family earning power over a lifetime. So this is the ticket of admission to America's middle class that we're talking about. Rising enrollments as Oregon's citizens get it and try to pursue to the best of their motivation and ability and financial capacity the higher education that they need. And yet we're seeing declining support. 12 years ago, the state's general fund amounted to 30% of the University of Oregon's budget. After this latest round of proposed cuts, it will be less than 17%. That is to say, the state's general fund share of the University of Oregon's operating budget will have been cut in half over the last decade. That's in the face of an all-time high demand for the kind of quality education that we try and, I believe, are successful in giving. Now, in a private sector, what would a business do? Would they downsize, cut the workforce, lower the production, lower the quality of their products? Is that what we want to do in higher education? Turn away students seeking an affordable education, compromise our quality so that the best and brightest of our students, in fact, leave the state? We know demographically, by the way, that two-thirds of those students who leave the state to pursue a higher education elsewhere will stay away. So that really truly is a brain drain of our best and brightest. And happily, as I think you know from earlier testimony on other matters, the brain drain's been reversed by our OUS institutions over the last few years. But we don't want to close our doors, and we think that just as businesses would have another option, we have it too. And that is to be more entrepreneurial, to operate more efficiently, and to pay more attention to our markets. That's exactly what we're trying to do in this measure. The chair and others have asked whether Oregon is being mimicked by other states. I would say actually with some degree of pride that we are leading other states. This measure builds on Senate Bill 271, the efficiencies of which have been documented over the last three or four biennia. But it goes farther in terms of state regulatory reform, recognizing that some of the principal obstacles to increased efficiency are created by state government institutions themselves. And it is those that we're seeking to penetrate, to streamline, to work with as we work with the provisions of Senate Bill 437. The state of Colorado, by the way, would, I'm sure, be one of the states that the chancellor will provide to you of states that has attempted through its institutions of higher education to find more effective ways of operating free of some of the regulatory shackles that were perhaps useful in an older time when state revenues and appropriations were at a different level. All of us have come together on this, as the chancellor has testified, and as you've heard from the testimony of Mr. Craven, this is not something that was a plot hatched at the last moment. It's been the product of very careful strategic planning, not merely on our campus, but all of the campuses, the state board, the chancellor, since he has joined us very happily in the state of Oregon just a few months ago. This bill is endorsed very broadly, as you can tell, and again, we thank those who contributed for the sponsorship. Conceptually, there are three things the bill tries to do. The first of it is giving increased flexibility in increasing non-state revenue, non-general fund revenues. The second is the regulatory reform aspect, and that is trying to operate more efficiently by removing barriers that are imposed, whether it's by the OUS system itself, whether it's by the executive branch in other of its activities, or whether it is by certain practices of the Oregon Legislative Assembly. And I think all of those are clearly identified. None of them perhaps now is a surprise to any member on the committee. But the reason that they're all included is because collectively they allow us to reach greater efficiencies that under the existing modes of operation we simply can't do. And the third leg of 437 is, of course, increasing our capacity to benefit by entrepreneurial activity. something that's been the subject, I think, Representative Smith, of your questions already this morning, and rightly so. The flexibility to retain our own tuition and fees, the establishment of a tuition and fee revolving fund. Of critical importance, and it's already been touched on, but I want to emphasize it because it is such a critical part of the bill, is the interest earned on the funds would be continuously appropriated to the OUS. And it follows a general principle that's observed in other parts of state government, but unhappily has not been observed with respect to students' tuition dollars. And that's the notion that interest follows principal, or interest should follow principal. I find that particularly poignant in the case of students who are asked to contribute increasing numbers of their the cost of their education to their tuition and fee dollars. And the interest on those funds, it seems to me, ought to be contributed in some way or another to the student's education instead of going to the state's general fund. I don't know of a major part of state government that is funded in this way that so disadvantages the students as the measure that we're seeking to change. So we support the use of those interest funds for the general instruction of students, or as Mr. Bender has pointed out to the committee, in the governor's proposal, it would be used as a source of funding for student scholarships. I might modestly disagree with the characterization that was given. This measure is not in conflict with the governor's proposal. It would be trumped by the governor's proposal. But it would be, insofar as the governor's proposal takes a constitutional amendment and a vote of the people, if 437 were to pass with its emergency clause, that would be in effect, and at least returning the students' dollars back to an appropriate source for their education unless and until the governor's measure passed. So in that respect, we do not see a conflict. And in principle, the governor's measure does the same thing as we are saying that 437 does specifically, and that is to say that the interest should follow the principal. The funds that are gathered from the students should be used to enhance the students' education or to support scholarships that allow more students to get that education on an affordable basis. If there are more questions on that subject, obviously we'd like you to return to them because it's incredibly important as far as this measure is concerned.
If I could break in, Representative Smith, did you have a question?
When he finishes.
Okay.
No, fine, thank you. I would simply note that community colleges do allow the interest on the funds raised from their tuition to be returned to the students. So in this respect, we're not asking for some new principle to be involved for post-secondary education. This already occurs elsewhere. We obviously want to make sure that students do have an access to a great education here in Oregon. We're trying to provide that. Scholarships is a major way in which we attempt to do that. I believe the committee knows, but I would repeat again that at the University of Oregon, we are engaged now in the largest fundraising project for any cause in the history of Oregon. We're in its silent phase. Scholarship assistance will be a major pillar of that fundraising effort, as I think is appropriate to the kind of need that we have today. Senate Bill 437 also speaks to issues of donor privacy that are critical to that fundraising effort. Again, this ought not to be something that is new in terms of the legislative horizon, because this has been a part of and is copied after provisions that now apply to the Oregon Health and Sciences University in terms of the attempt that it provides to screen certain aspects of personal privacy related to a donor that I think are eminently reasonable and indeed appropriate in this era when we're all of us conscious about issues of personal and financial privacy. I've mentioned OHSU, and I would repeat the point made by Mr. Craven earlier. This is not an attempt to establish an independent public corporation. Even after every jot and tittle of Senate Bill 437 were to be passed, the Oregon University system would still be a state entity. It would still be under general legislative control. It obviously has for generations been subject to a board that is confirmed by the Senate after having been appointed by the governor. In that respect, we made a deliberate policy decision not to separate ourselves from the state, but rather to ask for greater flexibility within the context of the state umbrella. As an example of the kinds of things that we can do, let me give one very quickly because it has worked and shows the kind of thing that flexibility of this sort gives us. We've actually established a tuition discount program based upon time of day. We give a 15% discount for students who take classes in the off-peak hours. in order to use our taxed facilities and our overtaxed faculty in the most efficient ways. We offer premium courses on those off hours, just as we do during the off on hours, and we found that they fill up to the maximum and that we can use our physical plant much more efficiently by being able to have that degree of local campus flexibility, deciding how much we want to charge based upon the hour of the day. It actually works. The market, the price mechanism actually work. And this is something that's actually received note as far away as the state of Virginia, where a friend of mine sits on a higher education board and has urged this program, thinking it didn't exist elsewhere, was reminded that Oregon had pioneered it. And it's one of those things that we can do creatively to try to get maximum leverage from the minimum number of dollars that we're getting from the general fund and from other sources. We're very much appreciative of the legislative interest in this proposal, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We believe that without the kind of flexibility that that this measure and others will bring, that the quality of higher education, notwithstanding our best efforts, will deteriorate. We don't think that that's what the committee wants. We don't think that's what the Legislative Assembly desires. And we want to postpone or eliminate that potential by this kind of measure. As you know, Chair Morgan, you and I have discussed these proposals for more than a year, dating back to a very happy breakfast meeting at Elmer's in Roseburg more than a year ago. And many other members of this committee have discussed these proposals with us as we have developed and refined them. You now see the 17 amendments. I hope there aren't 25 by the time that we're finished considering it. We do think that the passage of this measure is very, very important, not only as its substance, but also the symbol it sends that this legislature has confidence that greater entrepreneurialism on our part can be coupled with accountability and at the same time providing quality education to the maximum number of deserving Oregonians. We deeply appreciate your interest. We know that it is sincere and genuine and deep, and we thank you for this time this morning.
Thank you, President, for my questions or comments. Representative Smith.
When was the last time that our university system was engaged in a, I don't know a better word to use, an overhaul like this? As far as its management is concerned, or has it ever?
Representative Smith, I think of it as a continuous process. These have been very turbulent times. I spent the decade of the 1970s in the Oregon University system, and then I returned to it in the 1990s, just immediately following the passage of Measure 5 and the enormous sea change, tectonic change, if you will, that occurred then. As you may recall, at least from the headlines of that time, in the space of about 18 months, the university system cut 100 programs, schools, colleges, departments. It added back 12, so there was a net loss of 88 units. It consolidated units which were thought to be duplicated. You could at that time have gotten, before that time, have studied journalism at four different institutions. Now you can only study them one place. Schools of nursing were consolidated. Schools of education and departments of education were consolidated. And whole departments and schools were eliminated in many places. Following that, or contemporaneously with that, Representative Smith, there was also a project called the BARC project, which was basically an administrative review process, brought in a national accounting firm to oversee that, with the deliberate effort to cut back administrative costs so that shadow accounting systems could be eliminated, so that we could devote all of the maximum time to instructional rather than administrative expenditures. Then came the major reforms of 1999, in which the new funding model was adopted, which frankly gave a huge breath of fresh air, a much greater sense of institutional autonomy, a much more transparent financial system. And for the last 4 years, we've been operating under that, which has as one of its acronyms, although not all of them, the RAM model, the resource allocation model that replaced a truly archaic a mesh of gears and wheels that no one understood, called the BAS model. So that was probably the third or fourth measure. Senate Bill 271 had passed several biennia before that. That allowed us greater administrative consolidation. So I would think of this as a continuous process, sometimes very disruptive, at other times on a trajectory that has allowed us to operate much, much more efficiently than almost any system of higher education in the country.
Well, thank you. this bill, to me, is not that disruptive. To me, it would be a huge positive enhancement to what you're already doing. And I fully support your efforts and all the work you've done on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I would also add, I really appreciate your comments, President Frohmeyer, on the dynamics of the change within the system. I think that in this subcommittee, we've had some very interesting discussions as we've done public hearings on the operating budget related to how the RAM model operates in a declining general fund scenario and related to the fee remissions program. And I really appreciate having the dynamics of those discussions and the richness of the information that we've gotten out of the system as we've tried to do our deliberations here in this process. And I would agree with you that this is a very, very highly changing and evolving funding and administrative mechanism that we're looking at here.
Yeah.
And in terms of, I think that what we're seeing in the K to 12 system and the community college system, this is by far the most dynamic and changing part of education in Oregon right now.
Thank you, Chair Morgan. Can I just take 30 seconds to describe our issues of strategic planning? Because, of course, the Chancellor referred to a strategic planning process that's fully 2 years in the making. But in my own thinking of strategic planning, I use a metaphor different from the notion of starting at one plateau, then planning carefully to reach a next plateau, because you never get there. Frankly, my metaphor for planning is as much trying to navigate permanent whitewater. So those of you who are familiar with that particular sport know you have to keep the boat headed downstream, sometimes at an angle, but you also have to anticipate the rapids ahead. And unhappily, I don't think there's any period of quiet water. I think that's the reality of education, higher education. And I believe that we've recognized it perhaps earlier than some other institutions of government, or for that matter, other institutions in private industry, that we have to continue to have the mechanisms of a quick release, of fast maneuverability, of flexibility to deal with a changing environment, while keeping in mind that there is a destination down the stream, and that destination includes a lot of people and opportunity for a lot of people. So there's never one single point when we can say we've arrived, but hopefully the craft is always righted.
Thank you. Further comments or questions? President White.
For the record, I'm Tim White, President of Oregon State University, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Before actually starting my comments about Senate Bill 437, I wanted to come back to just give a little bit of an insight into what the emergency provisions could provide at a university, and certainly our finance and administrative people will get you something in writing that perhaps is more accurate than what I'm about to say. But nevertheless, when a spectrophotometer breaks in a laboratory where there's critical experiment that can't be stopped, that's the kind of purchase that may be a $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 purchase that has to be done quickly. Or if a chiller in an air conditioning unit breaks, and it's an air conditioning unit that's supporting animals in veterinary medicine or the operative theater in veterinary medicine, that's an example where we can't go through a several-month bidding process. And so it's those sorts of campus emergencies that affect the research enterprise or the facility enterprise where these things are imagined. It's not the routine purchases of paper and Xerox copiers and things of that nature. But anyhow, I'm sure you'll get a better and more detailed analysis. But as president, that's what I would be looking for as the basis of our exceptions.
Thank you. And what I'm looking for is to just kind of put some sideboards around the concept for the public record.
Yes. So we'll look for that letter to
but
be the declarer.
But your comments are insightful and do help us, I think, understand.
I didn't want you to go over the holiday weekend worrying about that aspect. Yeah. So. but again, let me thank you for the opportunity to discuss Senate Bill 437. And as you have commented, we're nearing the end of a rather incredible journey that goes back well over a year. And it really is fueled by our desire to make our universities not only more efficient, but also more effective for Oregonians and others who choose to come to our institutions, and also to be the very best use of the funds that you do provide to us over time. And it's moments like commencement, which from my point of view is the most important day in the academic year calendar, and at all the campuses recently, including Oregon State, we just went through commencement, and We provided degrees to a record number in the 134-year history of Oregon State University. We gave 4,050 degrees out on in the middle of June. And those are from students around the world. It represented 51 countries, 48 states, and happily all 36 counties from Oregon. And it's moments like that where you realize why these debates about Senate Bill 4037 and SJB 7 are so important, because it's that passage of students entering the workforce, and as my friend and colleague Dave Frommeyer said, a ticket to the middle class. It's a transformational activity. Well, as you know, we've changed the way we fund education, not only in Oregon, but around the country, and have moved to where a much greater part of the economic burden goes on the students and the families. And not here to complain about that. It is a regrettable national trend. You've heard about the seven presidents coming together on this bill. You've heard about the state system of higher education engaging in a couple-year process of strategic planning. And at Oregon State University, among other institutions, we've also done strategic planning coincident with this activity. And just this past May, I adopted a new strategic plan for our university, a path of distinction that is consistent with the sort of three words that are real important here. One is transformation. The second is evolution. And I think that comes back to Representative Smith's question about the last time we've overhauled. It really is an evolutionary process. And finally, about expectation of the provisions of SB 437 along with SJB 7. In many respects, I view these two bills, but the one we're speaking about formally today, as enablers. They will enable your universities, our universities, the state's universities, to do their business in the most efficient and effective way. The bill comes to you in its current amended form a bit lighter after what was originally proposed to you, and after much careful consideration and ready for your approval. Let me just focus on one of the provisions, as others have spoken to you previously about other vital elements. Let me also say that these provisions aid all seven universities in the state of Oregon. In Section 1, dealing with the Office of Degree Authorization, two sessions ago, you had a good judgment to create that funding model that allowed the resources to follow the students. And in so doing, then, this model responds appropriately, influenced by the job market that is out there. But if we do not have the ability to react quickly to changes in demand, we lose two things. We lose students because they will vote with their feet. And secondly, we will not make the very best use of taxpayers' funds because we're not providing programs that are as relevant to the demands of the job market as they might otherwise be. Under the current statute, when we offer a new program, we are subjected to a rather imprecise and ill-defined review by the Office of Degree Authorization. And quite frankly, it delays our ability to respond, it creates uncertainty, and in many respects, it prevents programs from coming forward because we're just not wanting to have to deal with that level of bureaucracy. And I think at an earlier time in testimony, I spoke a bit about our consideration of a program in physical therapy that we actually stopped because of the saber rattling that was occurring in ODA. And as a consequence, the state does not have a program in its public universities in physical therapy, despite the great need to do so. But at any rate, after careful consideration, the State Education Committee approved changes in the standards by which new programs may be reviewed. And it also created a schedule, a time-certain schedule, that allows any concerns to be aired and to be resolved. So, for example, with the passage of SB 437, if a private institution objects to a new degree program, the mediation process must begin within 90 days and must be resolved within 180 days. In addition, it changes to read that the Oregon Student Assistance Commission must approve new degree programs based on whether they meet an unmet workforce need. And finally, there's the removal of an imprecise word that actually was a very difficult word. The word seemingly was removed from the phrase if there is seemingly a detrimental duplication of programs. And those sorts of changes will help us be more clear and more effective in moving academic programs forward to serve our students, to serve Oregonians, and to serve the needs of the marketplace. So as I said, this is a very important enabler along with SJB 7 that ensures we're making the absolutely best use of funds for you to invest in our public universities. I appreciate the chance to visit with you and speak again with you.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Thank you very much, Presidents. I appreciate you taking time out of your very busy schedules to come and speak with us today. And we'll call Mr. McGee from DAS to come and talk to us about the governor's point of view on the bill. Do we have... We could do that right now if that would be fine.
Yeah. Thank
you. I have Mr. McGee before Ms. Ford on my schedule, but I'm very happy to change. Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Cheryl Ford.
And if I might just interject, this is one of my constituents, so be on your best behavior.
Thank you, Susan. For the record, my name is Cheryl Ramberford, and I live in Roseburg. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for considering Senate Bill 437 and for giving me the opportunity to speak today. I'm here representing the University of Oregon Alumni Association Board of Directors, on which I serve, and the U of O Foundation. The legislature before you came from two years of strategic planning that began at the University of Oregon to address the continuing problem of shrinking state support and increasing enrollment. Those of us involved in the planning process recognized that the university simply could not continue to educate all of the Oregon students that wanted to attend without compromising quality and access. Our goal was to develop a plan to continue to provide high-quality, affordable public education despite the state's shrinking support. One of the key areas addressed in our plan, and the area I am most interested in, is the objective of enhancing the student experience. That experience depends on students having access to a post-secondary education. My family is passionate about education and passionate that Oregonians should have access to education regardless of their financial means. That is why the Ford Family Foundation will provide $7.7 million in scholarships to Oregon students this year and has provided a total of $35 million in scholarships since 1994. My family is doing what it can, but the state must do more to ensure access. We must reverse the trend and invest in higher education, and we must give universities the flexibility they seek to truly enhance the student experience. I understand that you have a difficult task of balancing the needs of all state agencies, and right now there's simply not enough money to meet everyone's needs. That is why Senate Bill 437 is so important and why its passage is so critical. We must give our public universities tools to manage in this era of reduced state support. You heard from President Frohnmayer about some of the bill's specifics, but I want to offer my 2 cents on one of the proposals. The bill establishes a special account within the state treasury specifically for the funds collected from students, including tuition scholarships, tuition, and fees. The bill calls for interest earned on these funds to be appropriated to the Oregon University system. This change will keep student-paid funds and the interest on these funds within the budgets that fund the students' educational experience. It is very important to me, my family, and the constituencies I represent that both the principal and the interest on these funds, which includes the millions donated by my family, remain in the budgets that educate and provide access to students. I support using these funds for instruction or additional scholarships as proposed by the governor. I understand that allowing our universities to retain the interest on their funds could have an impact on the state general fund. But considering the proposed cuts in the OUS budget and what these cuts will mean to access and quality, this proposal in SB 437 is absolutely critical. It is imperative that the interest and principal and interest follow the students. I urge you to approve SB 437 and this critical component to the bill. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments for Ms. Ford?
I just have one comment. I really appreciate what you and your family have done in the education arena. I don't think maybe you get enough credit for that or you get enough accolades for what you're doing as a foundation. And I, for one, appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you so much.
I would like to take a moment just to express my appreciation to the Ford Family Foundation and There has been children that I've known and watched grow up from the time they were little chubby dubs in diapers to when they took their graduation from high school and went on. And I do know that there has been lives that have been changed in incredible ways by the Family Foundation coming in and funding people's education. And I know that you know that too, but I don't know that an awful lot of the people in the state know what a huge difference you've made, a real difference in young people's lives in the state.
Thank you for your comment.
Thank you. I have on my agenda Maddie Melton from the Oregon Student Association. Come on up. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Morgan and members of the committee, I am Maddie Melton. I am the chair for the Oregon Student Association and the president of the Associated Students at the University of Oregon. The Oregon Student Association represents over 100,000 students at all seven public Oregon University institutions, Lane Community College, and Oregon Health and Sciences University. We're here today to discuss Senate Bill 437. Senate Bill 437 came out of months of conversation concerning how Oregon's universities can thrive in a time of declining state support and increased enrollment. Students held meetings with administrators and board members as they finalized the agenda to present before the legislature. The result was Senate Bill 437, which was intended to provide institutions more flexibility and autonomy. Students believe that some of the issues presented in Senate Bill 437 are important as they allow the universities to function competitively in changing environments, but there is one change that the students strongly oppose. The Oregon University system entered the session asking for final authority over tuition, which would entail making tuition non-limited other funds in the Department of Higher Education budget, an approach that students oppose. Students worked on the bill in Senate Education, submitting amendments ensuring that tuition would be held in separate accounts from fees that do not have expenditure limitations. We are under the impression that the Oregon University system will not be working to further would not be working further to gain final authority over tuition this session, but we're worried that parts of the bill increase this possibility in future sessions. Section 23 in the bill is the part where tuition is discussed. Students support the Oregon University system keeping interest off tuition and fees, the money that students pay to attend colleges in its entirety should benefit the institutions they attend. We are still concerned, though, that gaining interest off tuition and fees and setting up new tuition accounts is a step towards the Oregon University system having complete control over tuition, as they had made that clear at the beginning of the session. In the context of the OUS's stated goals of having control over tuition and Senate Bill 437 being the first step in that process, we would like a chance to outline our concerns. First, university administrators claim that they will not be able to increase tuition above the market price or they will lose students. At a time when the demand for higher education is at an all-time high, the demand for a degree will continue to exist. But the students who will be able to fill that demand will change. Middle and upper income students will be able to pay the market price, but it will be low income Oregonians who will be priced out of an education as the price of tuition at public universities continues to increase. Students also fundamentally believe that the state has an interest in ensuring affordable and accessible education. Currently, the legislature is an integral part of a check and balance system that ensures that tuition is determined fairly and effectively. After hearing input from all affected parties, the legislature sets limits on tuition levels. If universities need to raise tuition over those limits which were set for the biennium. They simply must return to the legislature for approval. Lastly, students would be concerned that any change in tuition authority would cut students out of the process. Students have been involved in the tuition discussion as constituents for the past 30 years. There have been tuition increases and tuition freezes, but at every step of the way, students were involved. We just want to ensure that the legislature has a final say in how much tuition will increase. Our one concern with Senate Bill 437 has been the issue of tuition control, and it's our understanding that this issue has been laid to rest for the current session. We hope the legislature will indeed retain tuition oversight in this session and in future years. As for the rest of Senate Bill 437, we do support retaining interest off of tuition and fees. We support the changes in the Office of Degree Authorization, and we encourage you to continue your work on this bill. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Very good testimony. Questions or comments? Thank you again. At this point, I will call Bill McGee from DAS to come and give us the governor's view of the world here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We may be a little bit more modest than the entire view of the world, but we'll talk about this bill. For the record, Bill McGee.
Agenda, just fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management Division, and I'd like to just make a few comments specifically on the A-17 amendments that you have before you today. First comment is on Sections 20, 22, and 23, which would allow OUS to retain interest earnings on its other funds revenues account. As you know, the governor does support using interest on tuition and fees for a dedicated fund to promote access to higher education for students. You heard testimony about that last week. He does not support using these earnings for other purposes due to the overall general fund impact of making that change. So his support of what would essentially be a $5 million or perhaps larger impact is to the general fund is tied to establishing a constitutionally dedicated fund for access purposes. Second comment referring to sections 7 through 19, we see these as a very important technical fix to statutes that will allow interest earnings on funds that are provided for various capital construction projects to be retained by the project. In this case, we're talking about funds that may have been received from private donors, from federal or local governments, from businesses, lottery funds. And in many cases, the funding for the project assumes that the project will accrue the interest over the period of when the project is being constructed. And this has caused a couple of problems this session in handling these projects. Generally, we're not talking very much money because they don't really accrue for a very long period of time, but we do feel this is an important technical fix in the statutes.
Question.
Representative Smith.
Point of clarification. So you're saying in the past, donors who contributed money, say, to build Building X over on Campus B or whatever, that money, the interest off that money does not go to that project?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the intent is, and I think we have done so, but we found we found this session there was a project that was delayed for a period of time, and we ran into a problem where money was transferred to the general fund and needed to be transferred back to the project.
Okay.
So we're actually trying to fix the statutes to be certain that we can actually follow the intent. So there just isn't ambiguity in current law that we want to fix.
Just a comment on that, I would think that would be a very important fix because I would think the donors would assume that the interest earnings are not going into the general fund for something that they did not intend to fund, and that we need to keep good faith with our donors in that regard. If I were a donor, I would be a little bit upset.
Yeah.
I understand inadvertently how it could happen, but that needs to be very clear, and I thank you for
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, there was a donor who was unhappy, and that's how we finally realized that we needed to fix this.
And rightfully so. Rightfully so, absolutely.
Next comment is we need an additional amendment, which I understand OUS agrees with and will be drafted by the next time the bill were to come forward, that would clarify that information technology assets that have been acquired or developed through the use of certificates of participation will not be disposed of if those assets are used as collateral for the COPs. As you know, in the COP program, we collateralize a building or whatever we're using to fund to guarantee that the COP holders will be repaid. In this case, there is language in these amendments that deal with buildings, with structures, physical structures, but in sometimes we use COPs for information technology projects, so we just need to clarify that if a COP is used for a technology project or information technology equipment, that the OU system cannot dispose of that. This is, again, a technical fix that everyone agrees on. But
and these are, again, in the drafting process?
I believe that's true. You'll see those next time this comes forward. With the A-17 amendments, the concerns that I talked to you about you before regarding the Public Employee Benefits Board, use of COPs for match for Article 11G bonds, and the approval contract approved by the Attorney General have all been resolved successfully. So we're very supportive of those parts of removing those languages. For the record, we believe that the bill does not establish non-limited expenditure authority for other funds beyond what currently exists, so we believe the bill does not make any changes to grant additional non-limited expenditure authority to OUS. We are neutral on the remainder of the bill regarding the Office of Reauthorization, the various purchasing and contracting issues, the information technology planning language, and records confidentiality language. So there's no position from the governor or DAS on those provisions. And finally, the Section 26, which directs DAS and the Department of Higher Education to develop an unaudited review of the provisions of the bill, we're more than willing to do this, but we would like to have some discussion with your staff on the fiscal impact of that. There's some ambiguity, we think, in the way this is written, and we'd just like to know what it would cost DAS and OUS to comply. And that would be all I would have to.
Questions or comments, Representative Smith?
You didn't comment on Section 25.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we are neutral in that section. We've discussed that with our information management technology folks. They don't believe this is a significant change from current practice, so we are neutral in that.
So it would be okay for you then, and DAS, if the university system was able to go out and independently buy computer systems?
Madam Chair, we don't have objection to this language, so we believe that pretty much complies with what's currently occurring anyway.
Oh, really?
That's what our folks tell me. Not my area of expertise, but our folks don't have any objections to this language.
So maybe it's just a further effort to gain a little independence away from. Yeah. Maybe somebody else can comment on that.
Well, Madam Chair, OUS has also told us that they will work closely with us in planning, but we don't see this as a problem.
Don't they have their own people on each campus, though, that would do services that DAS would provide? I would think that, you know, they would have their media people, their technology people, I don't know what you call them, all of those techie people.
I'm sure they do have their own information technology folks to deal with,
you know,
their own systems.
They would know what they would need depending on the department and then the functions of their research or their whatever.
Madam Chair, they're responsible for their own for operating their own systems. They will cooperate with us now, and they'll continue to cooperate with us on issues of statewide planning. The central telecommunications system, we're not dependent upon them for the rates that we get, so we have no concerns here.
Thank you.
Mr. McGee, was there discussion? We've had discussion around the incompatibility of the record-keeping system, the bookkeeping system at the university system and the one that the state uses. And we, in fact, I think, are putting a budget note in the university system's budget to try to move them towards a position where the information is better able to be transferred straight across between the two systems. Is, in your opinion, is that an issue in Section 25?
Madam Chair, I don't believe it is. I think we're moving satisfactorily with them. I think the actual implementation of getting to where we want to be to provide that budget note is not going to take as much work as it might appear. I think their system does a pretty good job of translating to the codes in our system, so I think we'll be able to manage that pretty well.
Thank you. Representative March, did you have a comment?
I'm glad you mentioned Section 26, the audit, because I think it's a highly desirable and needed function. I see that we have time. The report back would be in 2007. So my preference would be to direct the Secretary of State and provide funding for that. to do that.
You're assuming that they still have an audit department at that point in time?
I think they will, seeing as it's in the Constitution.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments for Mr. McGee? Thank you very much. Mr. Kiernan, do you have a comment for us?
Yes, Madam Chair, Brett and Clarence. Again, there are three things which we've said we're going to return to you with. The Chancellor said he's going to give an environmental scan or snapshot of current activity regarding efficiencies and autonomy moves and entrepreneurial activities. I'm going to give you a copy of the Department of Justice and University of Oregon University System agreement on legal services. And third, we're going to give you a report on activities relative to the exceptions process, competitive bidding rules. Last, let me comment for the record so that you'll have it here. The witness from the Oregon Student Association correctly described and interpreted to you the university system's position regarding the unlimited, other funds unlimited status for tuition. The university system is not asking for that and will not seek it for the coming biennium and would leave the status quo with those funds in their current other funds limited position, allowing and requiring the legislature to set that expenditure limitation for those funds. We would, of course, want to include in that the interest earned with on those funds.
Thank you. Questions?
Respond to any other questions you might have.
Representative March.
Yeah, with regard to the exceptions process on public contracting, there's probably a number of procedural examples out there. For example, most counties have a procedure where you go to the board for an exception to the public contracting rule, and you may have in mind already how to do that. If that would be an acceptable substitute, if you have draft rules of what you intend to do, that would also help.
Madam Chair, Representative March, let me back up just one step. Remember that with Senate Bill 271 and with Senate Bill 437, the university system isn't exempt from any statutory oversight. The location of where the oversight occurs moves from an agency or other agencies, Department of Justice or Department of Administrative Services, to the university system itself. So we don't escape any statutory oversight.
Right.
Second, just as we did with 271, the State Board would draft Oregon administrative rules regarding how that exception process would be administered, and then the university system would pass on to the campuses what are known as IMDs, internal management directives, which lay out how that rule will be implemented and followed. And as you know, we were cited as one of the outstanding agencies for having a full and complete internal audit division. It is used to oversee the practices on those grants of authority which you have given us under 271, and which we're asking for under 437, so there would be post-audit on that. So, yes, it would be a standardized process developed under administrative rules with hearings, and it would be a board policy. You would retain statutory authority over the department in its activities under that statute. So I think we'll be able to show you the process that would be used, the internal audit oversight that doesn't exempt us from Secretary of State audit oversight,
right,
either, or the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. So we've got three audit opportunities. And we'll give you that report on the kind of exceptions we're talking about, so you do have the sideboards on the record to give you an idea of what's being asked.
Thank you.
Further questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
I will call now Mark Nelson and Bill Linden. Good morning, gentlemen.
Madam Chair, for the record, Bill Linden, representing the Association of Oregon Faculties. And we want to talk to you this morning briefly about one particular piece of the -17 amendments. Want to first state that AOF is supportive of the general and specific concepts within Senate Bill 437, and appreciate all the hard work that has gone into this, both by the subcommittee as well as the other advocates. The piece of the amendments we want to discuss with you this morning, though, deals with the deletion of the current authority that the State Board has to offer alternative benefit plans to faculty. What we have seen since the merger of the SEB Board and the BUB Board into the PEB Board is a constant erosion of health benefit offerings to faculty. Over the time in which PEB has been in business, for example, we have seen the cashback option disappear. Now, that was an option that many faculty took advantage of back when it was available.
Can you outline what that was?
Yes, Madam Chair. The cashback option was essentially an opportunity that faculty had and others had in state government to choose benefit plans, levels, and costs that would result in a total dollar amount that was less than what had been budgeted for that particular faculty member. And faculty were then able to take the difference between the budgeted amount for their health benefits and the amount they chose in terms of whatever plan options they selected, and that amount of cash back would then go to that particular faculty member. That option's gone. There's another option that faculty made wide use of, and that was to opt out of coverage. And it used to be that if that opt-out was selected, the faculty member would receive the amount that was otherwise budgeted for their benefits in terms of compensation. That level of compensation has now been reduced to 60% of what was budgeted for their particular benefits. Most of the dollars that have gone away from faculty in terms of opportunities to enhance their health benefit package or to make choices about their health benefit package that resulted in them receiving additional compensation have gone over to the other side of the ledger, where they've been used to subsidize enhanced benefits for what were BUB members. This is all in the context of, the three-legged stool we have in terms of total compensation for faculty. You're aware that in terms of comparator institutions, the salary levels are quite low. The retirement piece, which had always been a very attractive selling point, there are obviously changes happening there that are going to impact the long-term attractiveness of the retirement piece. The health benefit piece was the third leg of that stool, and we've seen that erode over the years. There's no question about that. We think that the board ought to be given the opportunity to retain the current authority they have to provide alternative benefit programs for faculty. Section 5 of the Ain-Gross bill provided that authority. It amended current law to hold in place a standard for providing alternative benefit plans to classified employees, and that standard was that these benefits would have to be the same at a lower cost. But it deleted that requirement in terms of the board's discretion to provide alternative benefit plans for faculty. We think it's important for the board to retain that authority. It doesn't mean they're going to be able to go out tomorrow and do it. But they're really dealing with a different population group in terms of faculty, and there may come a day where they're able to provide an alternative benefit plan for faculty that will be more attractive than what's going to be available through PEB. And we would ask that you consider retaining the language in the Ain-Gross bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions or comments? Representative Marsh, do you want to give Mr. Nelson a chance?
Absolutely, that's fine,
questions
too.
At the end?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll be very brief. to add to what Bill said, there used to be a state employees benefit board, which basically did benefit packages for non-represented employees. And then you had your bargaining unit benefits board, which did benefit packages for your represented, your union employees. When they merged these together, quite candidly, the bargaining unit concept took over the board. And from our perspective, there has been a constant erosion from the unrepresented employees to the philosophy, right or wrong, of the represented employees, which tends to be 100% coverage, full family, away from a cafeteria-like approach. And the opt-out and cash-back were concepts that allowed faculty and other management employees in the state to, but in particular faculty, to be able to choose what benefit package they wanted. And if they, and it wasn't, they weren't getting more money per se. They were getting the same amount of money as the cost of the package. But they could then turn, if they had savings because of their marital status or because of what they wanted in terms of benefit package, they could take that and buy other benefits. And it was very flexible. Call it a cafeteria plan. That has all moved to the bub concept. And we think that's wrong for faculty. And we believe very strongly that the system should have the flexibility to offer faculty who may be coming in for 2 years, they may be adjunct, they may be any kinds of situations, that to make it more flexible for faculty. So what was put into five was a recognition, one, that no classified employees in the higher education system should still be part of BUP. But if, only if, the state system wanted to make a change and could not negotiate with BEB for a change that recognized the difference of faculty, that they could go outside the system and put it together. So that's why Section 5 was important. Now, that section was supported by the Oregon University system. The governor and BEB have opposed that approach, and they have won out in amendments that you see. We're here to ask that, you keep Section 5 because it's very, very important to faculty
to
have that flexibility.
Excuse me, if I could just ask a technical question to you. When I read the original language in Section 5, the language that's in the Ingross bill that you're asking to be restored, am I reading this incorrectly? It appears that this applies only to the classified employees.
No. And it is difficult to walk through it. The original language said that the OUS system shall provide group insurance to its employees through the Public Employees Benefit Board, but may elect at the discretion of the State Board of Higher Education to provide alternative benefit plans to its employees should the same level of benefits be available at a lower cost than through the Public Employees Benefit Board. So what we've done is we've only applied those restrictions, the same level of benefits at a lower cost, to the classified employees, which has freed up faculty to be subject to another plan if the board chooses to do so. It's complicated, but that's how it reads. Let me do it in reverse. Notwithstanding any other provision of law, the Oregon University system shall provide group insurance to, let's say, faculty through the Public Employees Benefit Board, but may elect at the discretion of the State Board of Education to provide alternative benefit plans to its faculty, period.
Okay.
And then the rest is, except for classified employees who shall continue to be provided by the PEB, and as if the same level of, they can't go away from PEB unless the same level of benefits is available at a lower cost.
Thank you.
Representative Moore.
Okay, yeah. So to clarify, since the dash 17 is silent as to 351.094, it doesn't get your changes to current law in that you want, is what you're saying. That current law doesn't serve you well, and you need the changes to adjust for the faculty.
Madam Chair, Representative March, that is correct. The dash 17 is a basic rewrite of the bill.
Correct.
It strikes out and it just eliminates this page. And so you don't get to see it in 17.
It's right. It's silent to that section, and that's what. Yeah. That's this part. So current law doesn't serve your interests. You would want the changes that are in that section.
Madam Chair, Representative March, that's correct.
If I might just ask a question. We've seen, I think, over the last few years, as healthcare costs have been in double-digit inflation territory, and the insurance industry has tried to grapple with keeping costs down, we've seen cafeteria plans virtually disappear from the landscape, and one of the ways that cost containment is trying to be arrived at is by drastically narrowing down the choices that employees have when they sign up for benefits. So given that that aspect of it appears to be rolling away from us, given the desire to deal with the cost increases, and also the cashback part of what was available to people is also disappearing because of the cost increases in coverage. I guess what I'm confused about is how you see having this in there restoring that those two aspects of choice.
Madam Chair, it doesn't per se restore anything. It simply gives the board discretion without the current limitations in law to someday, if it's a good economic decision, to provide an alternative benefit plan for faculty that would be more advantageous to faculty, still cost effective, and it really comes back to what kind of group you're dealing with. In looking at the health benefit needs of faculty, there are differences in that group collectively than you'll see among state employees generally. So maybe it tends to be a healthier group of people. I mean, it doesn't restore anything. It someday could result in some changes in the benefit plans that are offered to faculty that faculty would find advantageous. It simply retains without the current restrictions discretion in the state board to make that choice someday if all the numbers line up and all the features line up and it looks like it's a good thing to do.
And Madam Chair, if I could add, we're not here advocating that cashback or addbacks are going to come back. Okay, we're advocating for the state system that understands its employees and particularly the needs of faculty, that they, as Bill said, at their discretion, that they could fashion packages that might meet the particular needs of faculty. Just like we do on the retirement side, the legislature's approved an optional retirement plan back in 1995 to recognize, and it's basically a defined contribution plan, to recognize that we've got faculty come in that's portable. They're going to come in for 3 or 4 years and they're going to leave, and they want to take it with them. So that's why that particular system has been set up parallel to the PERS system to recognize those particular needs. Again, we're not here to advocate. We're not going to redo cashback and all that. It was a concept that said we had a dollar amount, $400 a month. Someone may spend $280. They may go out and buy a disability policy. They may buy additional life insurance. But they were getting the same amount as the person next to them who was a classified employee, but they just might have spent it differently. We want that flexibility, and that's what we're trying to say.
Further questions or comments? Thank you very much, gentlemen. I have no one else signed up on the witness registration form, but is there anyone else in the room right now that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 437? And seeing nobody make any motions that would indicate, do you? I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 437. And, Mr. Bender, can you talk to us about our agenda for tomorrow?
For tomorrow, you're going to be in work session on House Bill 5028, which is the Higher Education Capital Construction Bill. We will have a copy of a recommendation circulated to your offices later this afternoon for tomorrow. And in addition to reviewing the projects again that were discussed at the public hearing earlier, you'll be getting a presentation on additional projects that the governor is now proposing to be financed by lottery bonds and higher ed capital construction.
So, committee members, part of the intent of the discussion tomorrow is to try to kind of bring together under one discussion umbrella all of the proposals that are on the table relating to higher ed capital construction. And if there's no further business before the committee, the meeting is adjourned. We'll reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning.